retaliatory strikes against the UAE going on. The Yemeni army hits Abu Dhabi and Dubai with ballistic missiles and drones. Tehran says it's awaiting Washington's political decision on the revival of the JCPOA, as it once again calls for the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. Plus, Russia hitting back at Britain's threat of sanctions over the situation in Ukraine. It says it will respond if its businesses are attacked. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The Yemeni army says it has hit significant targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in a fresh retaliatory strike. An army spokesman, Yahya Saria, says that several Zulfikar missiles hit very sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. Several targets in Dubai were also hit with unmanned aircraft. According to the general, the objectives of the operations have been met. He warned that the UAE will be under continued strikes as long as it launches operations against the people of Yemen. The army spokesman also warned Emirati citizens to stay away from sensitive facilities as they will be targeted in upcoming attacks. The UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that has waged a war on Yemen since March 2015. Hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed directly from war or indirectly from hunger and disease. I talked to our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif al-Washali, has explained if and when the Yemeni forces would eventually stop their attacks on Emirati sites.
The UAE has been escalating its operations, whether on the ground or the aerial attacks against the Yemeni people. So the Yemeni army will absolutely respond to these attacks and attack Emirati facilities. This third version of Yemen Storm operations will not be the last, even if the Emiratis announced withdrawing part of their forces in Yemen. The goal here is not only to make them or force them to withdraw some forces or stop the aerial attacks. Yemenis seek to expel all the Yemeni territories. They have to leave the Yemeni lands, and the Yemeni army will absolutely wage further attacks against whether Saudi Arabia or Emiratis. Yemeni people believe that the Saudi-led coalition, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are only proxies for the Israeli regime, so they will keep fighting these two regimes until the liberation of their land.
Now over to the Vienna talks on the revival of the Iran deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says that these negotiations will conclude once other signatories plus Washington make the right political decisions. Foreign Ministry spokesman says that a proper response to Tehran's rightful demands will result in an agreement in the shortest possible time. Said Khatibzadeh says that this deal will be reliable if other sides do not make any requests beyond the scope and framework of the deal. He said that the sources of disagreement between the negotiating parties are clear, and there are yet unresolved issues regarding the removal of sanctions in a verifiable way. Khatibzadeh stressed that Washington needs to provide sufficient guarantees that it won't violate international law again or target entities with transnational sanctions. The negotiating delegations will go back to Vienna to resume the talks in the coming days. Mohammed Marandi is an advisor to the Iranian negotiating team in Vienna. He has a recap of the basic elements in these negotiations and how they are proceeding.
They reached a point where those issues that need to be, that remain to be resolved, require major political decisions. And Tehran believes that the United States and its European allies have to make key decisions. If they want a nuclear deal, they're going to have to accept lifting sanctions. They can't expect Iran to go back to 2015 and implement the deal as it was back then, and then they remain with a framework of sanctions that they can use against ordinary people. That's just simply not acceptable. So they have to go back to their capitals. The Iranian delegation has come back to Tehran, and after a few days, they will be meeting again in Vienna to see where they can take things from there. Many issues have been resolved. As you know, a number of people from the American delegation were sent home, basically, arguably because the United States felt it had to be more flexible, and those two or three people were preventing that from happening. But still, that is not enough.
The Syrian military says its air defenses have intercepted a barrage of Israeli missiles fired at areas around the capital, Damascus. Syrian media quoted a military source as saying that the interception resulted in some material damage. The source added that the missiles were fired using Lebanese airspace. No word from Israel on the latest Israeli aerial raid. Israel has ramped up attacks on the Syrian soil in recent months. The regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, despite the country's repeated calls for action from the UN. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military and resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. A short time ago, we caught up with journalist and activist John Bosnich and asked him how Israel manages to continually get away with such blatant acts of aggression. Let's hear his response.
Well, we've got to start with the fact that we know that there's a high level of military integration between the United States and Israel. And we know now that there's another crisis ongoing in Ukraine, where the United States staged an illegal coup to overthrow the elected legal government of the country. And Israel has a tendency to work in lockstep with the United States. Whenever there's a diversion somewhere else that can draw the media attention away from any crime that might be committed by Israel, that's an opportunity for Israel to take an action. So behind the cover of the United States, behind the diversion of the activity in Ukraine, Israel can take actions which have a twofold purpose: to continue to attempt to destabilize the independent country of Syria, and to go through their regular war routine of testing their systems and seeing what they can do against countries around them.
It's news review time. Now, reports emerging of Lebanese intelligence services dismantling over a dozen Israeli espionage networks in the past month. According to local media, the networks operated independently of each other in both Lebanon and Syria. A number of arrests have been made. Some detainees had been using drones to collect intelligence. The Israeli spy networks reportedly collected information about Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and infiltrated into security services. This is the largest security operation performed since 2009, when networks belonging to the Israeli intelligence service Mossad were dismantled. Now, for more on that, let me invite a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent Mariam Saleh in Beirut. Also, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, is joining us from Brussels. Now, let's go to Beirut. Mariam, what's the latest about this news?
Well, what we do know is that 5 weeks ago, one of the major officers in the information branch in the Lebanese army, which is Consul of Ifarah al-Ma'lumat, he gave in a case where there was a clear indicators that there was some sort of intelligence activity being done in Lebanon. After a close follow-up of the suspect that was in this case, they were able to reach the fact that there was direct link with the Israeli Mossad, and that this suspect was not alone. There were 10 others, and that has been considered perhaps until now the biggest security operation in Lebanon, which has dismantled and uncovered Israeli spies. Now, this is not something new. And Hezbollah's resistance, in cooperation with the intelligence and the army and internal security forces, they are always, of course, on high alert and always ready to see that there would be some sort of infiltration by Israeli agents. But now, with the fact that you have more normalization of ties with Arab states between Israel and the Zionist entity and Arab states, then therefore this puts Lebanon under the scrutiny more of those agents that are able to go back and forth easily to Arab states, since it is not illegal to go to those Arab states where they could be meeting with Israelis, they could have a better contact with the Israelis that way. In addition to the fact that with the 2019 protests, you have a wider array of non-governmental groups and organizations which work under the umbrella of the U.S. embassy, basically, and that also makes it more possible for them to contact Israelis, and this is why this could probably be just one of the examples. We could probably see more examples and samples of sort of collaboration with Israelis, which is, of course, something that is punishable by Lebanese law.
Now, let me turn to Brussels. Elijah, I hear that you have some first-hand information regarding this, and maybe you were the first person who blew the whistle, huh?
Thank you for having me. Well, actually, it has been the investigation has been going on for the last 3 to 4 months when the intelligence services started to collect bits of information from the chat rooms and calls coming from abroad, from Lebanese lines. And this is when they started to realize what's happening, because the Israelis used to use Israeli phone numbers and give them to their spies in Lebanon, and these used to buy a separate phone and change the SIM card every time they call, making the duration of the call very limited. But Hezbollah managed to capture several of these, as well as the Lebanese security forces, and they were put in jail, and there was a serious investigation about it. And this war has been going on for the last decades, and now is going to become more aggressive with the relationship between Gulf countries like the Emirates and Bahrain and other countries who can come to Lebanon whenever they want, and they, with their friends in the country, they can easily support the Israelis with all the intelligence they want against the Palestinian groups, against Hezbollah, and even against the Lebanese army itself and the population. So this is why this what happened today is extremely serious, and it reveals a new style of the Israeli espionage that is never going to stop as long as Israel doesn't establish what it's called normalization with Lebanon and destroy Hezbollah, which is an impossible task because it's an organization that's made of a third of the population.
Right. And Elijah, apart from the scope of this and how significant that was, doesn't it also signify how vulnerable Israel is to cyber attacks? And also, you know, we had CCTV footage out just a few days ago, and they were hacked into, and also the same thing that happened, the news that we were talking about.
Well, the cyber technology is no longer the exclusivity of Israel. We see Israel is under attack. We see Hezbollah having this capability, Iran having this capability, and other countries around the world who can hack into the Israeli security system without major difficulties. But this war is going to continue because it is an ongoing war when the Israeli want to understand what other side is doing, and also the other side is also doing the same by trying to reveal what the Israelis are planning, what are their capabilities, and we have seen on the internet how this information has been exchanged with the location of all the sensitive area in Israel, and that is a war of deterrence that is useful to tell the other side, if you want to attack me, I know exactly where you are and where your sensitive areas are that I can also bomb, and I have the capability to do it. So it puts off the Israelis from further aggression toward Lebanon and Hezbollah and the Palestinian Hamas.
All right, thanks for that. Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Beirut, and Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst in Brussels. Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Moscow threatening to respond. Britain moves to sanction Russian companies close to President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin has expressed alarm, warning that any attack on those firms could backfire on British shareholders in Russian companies. Britain has said that it will tighten its sanctions on businesses and people linked to Putin if Russia invades Ukraine. The U.S. and its NATO allies accused Russia of amassing troops near the border to attack Ukraine. Moscow rejects the allegation. It says its move is in response to NATO's deployments in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. Russia has demanded written guarantees against NATO's eastward expansion and the signing up of Ukraine as a member. Now Boris Johnson facing a make-or-break week in his premiership as he's bracing for the publication of a government report into lockdown-busting parties at Downing Street. The Treasury Chief Secretary says that the findings of the Sue Gray report will be released soon. The inquiry will look into a string of revelations of gatherings held on government promises in violation of COVID lockdown rules. The allegations have prompted the worst crisis of Johnson's tenure. Also facing several other scandals, the Prime Minister and his Conservative Party have seen their ratings plummet. He's facing calls from across the political spectrum, including his own party, to quit. Johnson himself has not been consistent in his response to the revelations. He's gone from denying that such parties ever existed to denying knowledge of them to recently saying that he believed them to be work events. North Korea has confirmed the launch of an intermediate-range ballistic missile believed to be the most powerful since 2017. The state news agency says the missile was test-fired in a way to ensure the safety of neighboring countries. Meantime, the United States has dismissed the test as part of Pyongyang's increasingly destabilizing program. It's urged North Korea to join direct talks on its nuclear and missile programs and said that Washington would have no preconditions for such meetings. The launch was first reported by South Korean and Japanese authorities on Sunday. Analysts and officials say it's the first time a missile of such dimension has been launched since Pyongyang's self-imposed moratorium on tests of nuclear weapons in 2017. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. Economic divide.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi just wrapped up his two-day visit to Russia, and what a visit it was. He said that Iran and Russia have reached fundamental agreements on expanding ties. Hi, I'm Kavit Atlay, and in this edition of the program, we will look at what these fundamental agreements are in the expansion of ties, especially in the economic sphere. Some of the highlights coming up in today's program: how to challenge dominance and continue trade in their national currencies, especially when it comes to oil, with a promise to increase bilateral trade from the current $3 billion to $10 billion. We'll also take a look at a very important agreement, the 20-year cooperation roadmap. It will be worked on by both nations, first the Chinese 25-year agreement, and now this. We ask, will this be enough to challenge sanctions? Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani has a surprise answer on that. And in what is a first, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's address to the Russian lower house of parliament, the Duma, you don't want to miss those highlights. He said, among other things, the U.S. uses the dollar as a weapon. All coming up.
It was a trip that was hailed as a success. The two-day visit of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to Russia at the personal invitation of the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
We can promote our relations in the economy, trade, on the political track, and in all these spheres. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have no restrictions, and nothing holds us back from further developing our ties with friendly Russia.
Vladimir Putin also had kind words for him.
I would like to note that despite the pandemic, even last year, we saw a slight increase in trade.
He even addressed the State Duma, Russia's lower house of parliament.
Sanctioning nations is a common form of new domination. Encountering it requires cooperation of sovereign states and a collective response. Otherwise, sanctions will affect all countries, even U.S. allies, under various pretexts.
Iran's president said that a visit to Russia could be a turning point in political, trade, and economic relations between the two countries. The U.S. weaponization of the dollar was a key topic of discussion, which he said the two sides discussed steps to challenge the dominance of the U.S. dollar and to continue trade in their national currencies.
The main principle is that we do not want to gain dominance over other countries and are not ready to be dominated by other countries. This is the principle. One shouldn't oppress others and shouldn't be suppressed by other countries.
Iran's economy minister was also optimistic about the outcome of the trip. Meanwhile, the foreign ministers of both countries announced that they were set to update the 20-year cooperation treaty that they had signed in 2001.
We have this strategic document in the making, aimed for a 20-year perspective. It is a comprehensive document. It includes all areas of cooperation, and it can determine the prospects for all participants in economic and market activities in the field of technology, defense, and so on.
One outcome of this trip has been Iran's and Russia's efforts to complete the North-South Corridor.
Cooperation was in the framework of the two main international transport routes, which are north-south and south-west, offers great opportunities for both countries.
This is a rail route in Iran that would be integrated into the International North-South Transport Corridor, NSTC, a multimodal route linking India and the Persian Gulf to Europe. This is a major international route, which they said is of great economic significance for both Iran and Russia.
When the Iranian president touched down in Russia, it was not exactly known what would happen in terms of his meeting with the Russian president or in areas like trade. First, his meeting with the Russian president drew a lot of social media reactions. For example, this picture, the Iranian president Ebrahim Raisi seen here praying at the Kremlin while on his state visit. Now, the Russian president, based on the Russian Federation official website, noted how, despite the pandemic, he said, we increased trade even the year before last. This increase was not big, over 6%, but it was still an increase. Last year, however, trade grew by more than 38%. We are carrying out major projects in many areas. Now, one way of increasing trade is what the Russian president noted to Iran's President Raisi, that Iran and the EAEU are developing relations on a temporary basis under a temporary agreement. It added, we are doing much to create a long-term foundation for cooperation and a free trade area between Iran and our union. It's time for our definition check. What is the Eurasian Economic Union? Well, it came into effect in the year 2015, and it consists of five countries: Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Russia, with the aim of fostering closer economic cooperation among the member states for the well-being of the people of the region. Now, noted columnist and writer Pepe Escobar on Eurasian integration tweeted, "This visit by Ebrahim Raisi, which I am making at the invitation of Vladimir Putin, could be a turning point in Iran's political, economic, and trade relations with Russia. They meet later today in Sochi. Eurasia integration rolling." And this is what the U.S. gets when it pushes countries that it sees as its adversaries for not following its line. With the U.S. and allies' expansionism policy in full flow, Russia, China, and Iran should start a real multilateral movement to include same-minded states to oppose them on all fronts. This movement should be constructed on mutually beneficiary policies. But when it comes to the U.S. weaponization of sanctions, which, let's be real, the dollar is a major part of it, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Dr. Ali Shamkhani, had this to say about U.S. sanctions when it came to Iran's oil. He said Iran's oil trading and its financial affairs has reached appropriate and irreversible conditions. It is not possible to promise to lift a sanction that has become ineffective in order to score a point. He followed that with a hashtag by the name of active resistance. And then this tweet came about by China, which was also very telling in terms of the timing. China announced that it would put 4 million barrels of Iranian oil into state reserves despite U.S. sanctions. Okay, joining us in this segment, we have two guests. First, we have a guest in our studio, Ruhollah Mudabber joins us. It's a pleasure having you. You are an expert on Eurasia and Russian Federation affairs. Thanks for joining us here in the studios. We also have with us Dmitry Babich. He is a radio host and political commentator. I'm going to first start with you, Dmitry Babich, and get a reflection from you on the Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. He has said three things as top priorities. Quote, a neighbor-centered policy, an Asia-centered policy with a focus on looking to the East, and an economy-centered diplomacy. Now, both Iran and Russia are redoubling their efforts in their relationship, with Iran having this stance. In terms of the two, how do you think that will contribute to one of their goals, de-dollarization?
De-dollarization is a requirement of the day. It is clear that reliance on the dollar when the United States is basically behaving very irrationally under Trump or without Trump, the United States is behaving more and more irrationally. So the fact that we have to be dependent on its currency is very dangerous, you know. Independent of who is in charge right now in Washington, it's dangerous now to be dependent on the American currency.
Our guest there talked about what I led and into, and that was de-dollarization. Iran has the focus centered now towards the East. The top three priorities, according to the Iranian foreign minister, a neighbor-centered policy, an Asia-centered policy with a focus on looking to the East. Tell us how this union between Russia and Iran in particular will lead to de-dollarization, which our guests there confirmed.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Hello, I would like to extend my warmest welcome. The foreign policy of Iran's 13th administration is based on honor, wisdom, and diplomacy with its counterparts, and it has been approved by Iran's leader. There is a special consideration and attention given to jump-starting economic diplomacy and decreasing its reliance on Western-dominated international financial institutions. The establishment of ties with Russia, which has been done under a short period of time under the new administration, which has been in power for only 5 months, on the one hand, enabled it to join the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which covers security and economic spheres. Russia's influence in the Eurasia region and Iran's integration into this region through aligning with Russia will enable it to Iran to stand up to the WTO, which carries the sanction regime policies of the U.S. Russia has, in the meantime, reduced its dollar reserves to less than 50%.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Time for our InfoNews section, which has been upgraded in the past few weeks in order to expand more on a piece of news that we thought would need more explaining or attention. We hope you like that. First up, the U.S.-Russia crisis. Yes, it's going to affect the world energy prices, in particular oil, as you have seen, which is already seeing prices at around $87 a barrel. And in terms of the Russian economy and how it would cope, well, Russia has reduced the country's exposure to the U.S. dollar, shifted assets out of the U.S., and sold a smaller share of its debt to foreigners. On to our next story, Chinese currency, the yuan. This currency has risen in ranks of top global currencies. It has reached its highest level of popularity in cross-border payments since the year 2015. That means that it is among the world's top five most popular currencies for cross-border payments, securing the fourth spot for the first time in 6 years. Now, this should give the dollar some worries. Moving on to UK inflation. UK inflation, like other parts of Europe, if not the world, has risen. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's problems just keep mounting when it comes to, obviously, this on top of the Partygate scandals. But this one hurts more because it has hit a 30-year high, the highest level since 1992. Inflation has hit an annual rate of 5.4% for the month of December. So another problem for the Prime Minister and his administration to deal with on top of the scandals. Finally, we're going to go to what's called Citizens United. But first, let's do a definition check. First, the definition of Citizen United. It was a ruling in the U.S. that unleashed a tsunami of dark money into U.S. politics. This past week marked the 12th anniversary of one of the most destructive rulings ever issued by the U.S. Supreme Court, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. What has been the outcome of this controversial ruling? Well, the billionaire is pumping money, millions of dollars, into the U.S. elections, which worked against Americans and it worked against Main Street. It is something that has plagued U.S. politics for quite some time, and many are against that because what the billionaires have done is they have rallied politicians to have their back as opposed to the Americans and everyday people there in the U.S. Well, that does it for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section. When it comes to Iran's trade, there is a sense that the country is in the cusp of major increases in its volume worldwide. Now, let me explain why that there is a consensus to that effect. First comes Russia. New agreements were made with Russia. The current volume of annual trade exchanges between Iran and Russia, which stands roughly at around $4 billion, some estimates say three, roughly, however, $4 billion is what we have, will increase to at least $10 billion. That's projected. Russian oil companies have announced that they plan to make investments in Iran's oil fields according to the new agreements. Let's not forget also the 20-year Russia agreement, which foreign ministers of both countries have announced that they are working on. Now comes the plans for Iran's membership at the Eurasian Economic Union. It's called the EEU. But we're going to take a look at that in the context of Russia's annual imports. Russia's annual imports are $200 billion. That's within this union and outside of it. If Iran has a share of that, of at least 10% of the $200 billion in Russia's annual imports, well, a major development will take place in the economic sector for Iran. The Russian president had said that Iran should reap the benefits of trade that exists in the EEU. And these are some of the countries that are, not some, but all the countries that I remember at this point. And that's how Iran could reap the benefits of being part of that union.
There is also a provisional agreement that regulates Iran's relation problems with Eurosec, the Eurasian Economic Commission, and we are proactive in creating a lasting foundation for creating a free trade area between Iran and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Wow, a free trade area is something that I neglected to include in this section. And that's a big deal. That actually will lead to Iran having more in its trade with that union. Now, next up, we're going to talk about Iran's membership at the SCO, which happened recently. SCO is major, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, 3/5 of the Eurasian continent, 40% of the world population, and 20% of the world's GDP is in this Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So obviously, the numbers speak for themselves. Now, China's trade is $258.8 billion. When you take a look at its overall trade that is in this organization, Iran's trade is $28 billion. So you can see how small Iran's trade is relative to China's. And then again, Iran can reap the benefits now that it's a member to increase that volume of $28 billion. All right, now we're going to take a look at the Iran-China annual trade between the two, bilateral trade that happens. What are we looking at? Well, 2018, it went up to roughly around $40 billion from what I'm saying. Oh, a little bit more than that. Let's take a look at the average here. So a little bit over $40 billion for 2018. 2019, roughly around $40 billion, a little less. And then 2020, it went down. And 2021, it has come up to around $60 billion. It seems like $50 to $60 billion is the bilateral trade, more or less, but on the rise. And now that the Iran-China 25-year agreement is in its implementation stage, well, things can only get better. Why mention these facts? Well, let's take a look at the reasons behind that. Iran is actually capitalizing on its Asia-centered policy, which will involve de-dollarization. Now, that's something that Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, has said. He has said Iran has three top priorities: a neighbor-centered policy, an Asia-centered policy with a focus on looking to the east, and an economy-centered diplomacy. Okay, let's find out what our guests think. Rejoining us for this section is Dmitry Babich, radio host and political commentator. All right, Dmitry Babich, welcome back. Iran already enhancing its ties, obviously, with countries like Russia, like China, and also becoming a member at the SCO, which is a big deal after being a permanent member for quite some time. Do you think that the U.S. hostile policies has actually alienated the U.S. on the one hand while pushing countries like Russia, alienated the U.S. on the one hand while pushing countries like Russia, China, and Iran together?
Yes, so the United States simply left no choice to Iran, Russia, and China but to cooperate. We might have longer periods of, I would say, uncertainty between our three countries, unless the United States acted so resolutely.
Okay, Dmitry Babich there talking. Let me now turn my attention to Ruhollah Madaber, who's here in the studios with us. Ruhollah Madaber, you heard our guests over there, and basically I'm going to come at you with another angle, and that was something that the Russian president actually spoke to Iran's president Ebrahim Raisi at the Kremlin, and that was regarding the successful relationship between Iran and Russia when it came to Syria. Obviously, the union there and the cooperation led to lots of successes for that country. And my question to you is, won't this type of cooperation go against the U.S. interest and for then the U.S. to try to prevent Iran and Russia to cooperate on different issues when it comes in the region, in particular, obviously, when it comes to economic transactions between the two?
An important strategy point that was made by the Russian President Vladimir Putin in the three-hour conversation that he had with Iranian President Raisi at Kremlin, and Mr. Putin's personal result-oriented personality, was made at the beginning of the conversation after sending his greeting to Iran's leader. It was about the successful experience that Iran and Russia had when it came to Syria, but it had to do with the Shahid Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani recommendation and his anti-terrorism fight, something that Iran and Russian Federation continued against these Daesh terrorists. This successful cooperation was so important that the Russian president in the meeting with the Iranian president, Raisi, repeated this again. This successful cooperation between the two also poses a problem for the U.S. because ever since the Cold War, the most important issue for the bankrupt U.S. is that good relation is not developed between its adversaries, especially now that the Islamic Republic is experiencing hard-hitting sanctions. Iran's military and navy has become so strong. Recently, there were massive navy drills that took place between Russia, Iran, and China, which showed that Iran's navy has reached such a strength that it can serve as being protector of these very important and strategic waterways.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Wish we had more time. Ruhollah Mudavar in the studio with us, expert on Eurasia, Russian Federation affairs. Many thanks for joining us here and on the Economic Divide.
Iran has had two major developments recently that will affect trade volume tremendously. Let's first take a look at the 20-year agreement that Iran and Russia have announced. The announcement was made by Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who said the Iranian and Russian presidents have tasked their foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for cooperation over the next two decades. What is misunderstood here is that it's not a new agreement, but one that is being updated. In 2001, Iran and Russia signed a 10-year cooperation agreement, mainly in the nuclear field, that was extended to 20 years through 2 5-year extensions. The 20-year agreement, discussed by Mr. Putin and Mr. Raisi, focuses on technology transfers from Russia, the purchase of Russian military equipment, and Russian investment in Iranian energy infrastructure. Which brings us to the next agreement, one that Iran and China have signed, a 25-year agreement, one that has now reached the implementation stage. Iran has said the Russia-Iran agreement would actually be modeled after this accord. It's been described as a sweeping deal that includes economic, security, and military cooperation. It is reported that China will invest in a wide range of projects in Iran, such as oil, gas, and petrochemical industries. One of the key provisions is noteworthy, creating a special mechanism to aid banking transactions between the two countries in the Chinese currency, the yuan, and working to make Iran the center point of China's Silk Road's commercial route in West Asia. Remember, an official release of all these details has not been done, so any provisions can't be confirmed. But with the U.S. sweeping sanctions on Russia and China, with the most intensive sanctions on Iran as well, the three countries are keen to unite as a bulwark against the U.S. hegemony. Okay, that's the end of this segment of the program. Hope you liked it. If you have any questions or comments, please send it to us. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye. Until next week's program.
Well, it's time for our parting thoughts here. We dedicated two shows to this topic, Iran and the occasion of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Russia. Why did we do that? The reason is because for the first time in a very long time, the U.S. foreign policy has aligned Iran, Russia, and China's economic and foreign policy objectives against the U.S., which has acted belligerently against these nations, from military threats to sanctions to the weaponization of the dollar. Russia and China now have no doubt about the U.S. hostile intentions against them, something that Iran has been dealing with for decades. That does it for this edition of the program. We do appreciate it if you send us your comments and questions, especially on this program. We would love to hear from you. From me, Kavit Tahwei, and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi assalam. Amir al-Mu'minin's aim and vision in life and his objective in life was to establish equality and equity and justice for all people and for the whole society. To the extent that he used to constantly look around, watch, walk in the markets of Kufa and make sure that everything is all right. So one day, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi paid a visit to one of his companions who seemingly had a big house. He was a wealthy man, obviously, so he had a bigger house. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he came in the house and he says to him, "Of what use to you is a spacious house in this world when you stand more in need of a spacious house in the hereafter, where you have to live eternally?" So obviously, Amir al-Mu'minin trying to shift the man's attention that yes, you have money, yes, you have wealth, but you need to make sure that you spend it wisely and give most of it and give a portion of it at least to those who are less fortunate, those who are deprived. So the Imam trying to tell him that it's not in this world that you need to have a big house. It is in the hereafter. And why? Because the hereafter is eternal. This world will end, and me and you, whatever we earn, it will be taken from us, will be given to someone else. So we constantly want bigger houses, faster cars, this and that, and we want to live happy. But happiness is not meant to be in this world. The true happiness is in fact in the hereafter. Yes, we can have big houses, yes, we can have all these things, but there are surely more things important. Then Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he continues his debate or dialogue or discussion with this companion of his, and he says to him, "Of course, if you also desire a spacious house in the hereafter, then you should entertain guests in this house. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you a big house. You can have that big house in this world, and you can also have even a bigger house in the hereafter, considering that you use this house to serve and shelter people who are in need, to bring guests in, feed them, clothe them. If it's winter, bring them in, let them sleep, because a lot of people will sleep in the streets back in the day, and we still have that problem, which we call homelessness. So the Imam says to him, if you entertain guests in this house, behave well with the kingsmen. Don't act with pride and arrogance that you're rich and you have bigger house and no one else does, and so on and so forth. And pay the right of others when it comes to homes and zakah on appropriate occasions. If you do so, you will be successful in this world and in the hereafter." So obviously Amir al-Mu'minin is trying to say, yes, you can live up your life, have a bigger house, but considering there are other things that need to be done, that the house itself, you can use it for good work, and it does not become a point of pride, nor would it become a point where you divide yourself from people and you become class and they are below you. And obviously make sure that you are doing your Islamic duties by paying your taxes Islamically. Therefore, you will be successful in both worlds. Let's take a break, then we will continue right after.
Mm-hmm. Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, Human Justice from the Perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullahi alayhi, one day he was having a discussion with his companion Kumail ibn Ziyad in regards to the importance of fasting and praying. He says to him, "O Kumail, it is not important that you should offer prayers or observe fast and pay zakah. What is important is that you should offer prayers with a pure heart and in accordance with the desire of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." Now, most of the times we do things, but we do them because we are forced to, not because we want to do them for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We don't have that pure heart and pure intention. So he says to him, while doing so, you need to think of others. You need to think of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala first and foremost. When it comes to praying, when it comes to giving zakah, prayer itself, it was meant to fix and rectify your behavior with people. Fasting is meant to make you feel the pain of other people. Zakah and charity and taxes is meant to make you give other people. So all these ibadat, they are for Allah's sake. But at the same time, they have a human connection to it as well. Even before the hereafter, he was so anxious about the life of the people in this world that in spite of him being the Khalifa, he used to go to the markets of Kufa as a matter of a daily routine. He stops at every shop and he says, "O merchants, fear God, seek proximity to the customers, adorn yourself with the forbearance, don't swear, don't tell lies, avoid injustice, be just to the opposed and weigh and measure properly. Don't give the people lesser than the Jew. Don't spread corruption in the world." That was Amir al-Mu'mineen saying these words on a daily basis to the merchants and to the dealers and to the shop owners of the market of the Kufa. He is constantly trying to remind them that they need to be just, they need to be fair to the people that they live amongst. Because some of these merchants, some of these dealers, they take more profits, which puts people in a lot of hardship. And sadly, we still see the same things in our currently so-called modern world, where prices are so expensive that a lot of people can't afford the simple things. If it costs a company $1 to make, they sell for 20. And you can see that people in society are suffering because of this, where Amir al-Mu'mineen used to come to these merchants on a daily basis and he tells them to be just and fair and create that sense of equality amongst people by becoming giving when it comes to measurement or coming to asking for profit to be fair and just. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.